4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we take a look at why the speed of life is changing our lives, maybe for the worse.
First, we continue our look at the results from yesterday's midterm elections. It was a huge night for Republicans in Wisconsin and across the nation. Here in the state, Governor Walker won his third election in the last 4 years. On the national level, Republicans held the House and took the Senate.
There are plenty of questions to be asked today as Republicans savor their victory and Democrats lick their wounds. And even though we just finished up a long and grueling election season, the 2016 elections are already looming large.
Here to give us some analysis of what happened last night and where things go now is Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. She joins us now from our studios in Milwaukee. Lily, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, let's start with the big ticket item here, the race for governor. A lot of predictions over the last couple months of a very, very close outcome. Not so much. Governor Walker got a pretty handy win. What do you see accounting for that margin that was wider than many expected?
Yeah, I think Walker ran a really good, smart campaign. He ran a disciplined campaign. He talked to Wisconsinites about Wisconsin. He contextualized it in terms of how's Wisconsin doing and where the problem's coming from with regard to Washington, D.C. He didn't have a lot of high-profile sort of Washington, D.C. types coming into campaign with him. The only one who really did come and he invited him was Chris Christie as the chair of the Republican Governors Association. But for the most part, Walker campaigned with Wisconsin politicians and he made it about defining Wisconsin and his work here for the last 4 years.
Now, on Mary Burke's side, did something go wrong with her campaign, or did she run a solid campaign but there wasn't much she could do?
I think she ran a solid campaign, but I also think that she sort of ran a campaign of not being Scott Walker. And she didn't necessarily light on fire sort of these are the policies, these are the immediate directions that I'm going to take, this is the way I'm going to do things so much differently. It was more, I think, in a lot of ways, I am not Scott Walker, and I'm not going to do the same things he did, and I'm going to be a different person. But I think even towards the end, she remained fairly nebulously defined.
Now, this is a different kind of candidate for Democrats, at least in the race for governor. We saw Herb Kohl, a wealthy business-related individual in the Senate. Do you think Democrats will take a lesson here, go back to politicians, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's a little bit too soon to tell. And again, when you're running a statewide race, you have to have somebody who, may have some statewide recognition, and that in the past had been Tom Barrett, who was the mayor of Milwaukee. There are other people in the state who maybe can run again in 4 years against Walker if he's still the governor, if he's going to run for re-election. But it is sort of difficult to see who the pool of possibilities are sometimes with regard to the Democratic bench in Wisconsin, because a lot of it is also seems to be pretty Milwaukee or Madison centric.
Is that a chronic problem for Democrats? I've heard that thought that they don't have a deep bench, but you could name a lot of Republicans who might step up, say, if Scott Walker went national. Is there something that the parties are doing differently that leads to that situation?
Well, I think it's also where I think in Wisconsin, it's also where the support for the parties is. And the Democratic Party has strongholds in Dane County and in Milwaukee. And the Republicans have strongholds that are more broadly spread out in possibly less populated areas. And that's mirroring a lot of the way the demographics for the parties is working nationally. The Democrats tend to be more concentrated in urban areas, and Republicans tend to be more specifically concentrated in smaller suburban and rural and smaller towns throughout the country.
Now, I know a lot of eyes nationally are on Scott Walker as a potential candidate for president, but also are there eyes on how this campaign was run? Are people looking at this as a model for elections in other states around the country?
I think that Scott Walker did a good job running this campaign, and it was really interesting to look at it in that context, because you also have to remember that there wasn't a Senate campaign this year. So Walker didn't have to essentially worry about the fact that either Ron Johnson or Tammy Baldwin, were running a Senate campaign as another statewide campaign, but for a Washington office. So to some degree, he had the field cleared out at the state level that he didn't have to necessarily worry about how another statewide race was going to be run. And in a certain, I don't want to say it's a luxury, but he had the capacity, and his campaign team had the capacity to run a race that was essentially about Scott Walker and Wisconsin, as opposed to having to worry about a Senate race also that was going to be defining Wisconsin and looking nationally in a different kind of way. I think he also really was disciplined. And again, this had been some of the problems that faced Republicans, mostly in Senate races in previous election cycles, that they had candidates who were not necessarily on discipline, on message. They had said things that got them into trouble. And Walker has run pretty consistently in the three gubernatorial races that he's run in 4 years ago, as well as in the recall. He's been pretty consistently on message, which again makes him potentially viable as a kind of presidential candidate because he knows how to sort of craft a message and stay on it.
And we'll dig down into some other races, but big picture for the Democrats, they didn't take the governor's office back. Republicans still have the attorney general. Democrats are hoping for pickups in the state Senate. Didn't get them. As big a loss in some ways as Democrats saw in 2010, what do they do to dust off and rebuild? Or do they just have to wait for another presidential year where they can hope for coattails?
Well, I think, and again, you know, you have a different, it's been very interesting to look at the numbers and who's voting demographically, not only in Wisconsin, but nationally, that there's a different electorate that comes out in a non-presidential year. And so it's not even per se traditional kind of coattails. It's also who votes in a presidential year versus who comes out or doesn't come out in a non-presidential year. And the demographics with regard to the age of the electorate nationally this time was really substantially different than it was 2 years ago, with seniors making up over 37% of the electorate and the under 30 voters at 12%. In 2012, they were almost 20% of the electorate across the nation. And so that's a sizable demographic shift in terms of the national numbers as well as state numbers.
So the mission for Democrats that they apparently fell short is convincing younger voters likely to support Democrats that elections outside of presidential elections matter.
Exactly. It can't just be about, you know, the top of the ticket.
Well, speaking of the top of the ticket, let's take a step below that now. The attorney general race, the other really big statewide one, Republican Brad Schimmel ran against Democrat Susan Happ. He won to replace J.B. Van Hollen. Did what they said really matter, or was it just Democrats supported their candidate, Republicans supported theirs, and that's what determined it?
I mean, I think there is, you know, there is part of that going on in this particular climate in Wisconsin, that, you know, people were coming out and this was a I'm voting for Scott Walker or I'm voting against Scott Walker. And to some degree, a lot of the other folks on the ballot benefited or didn't from that kind of approach to, you know, what this race was about. And so in a certain sense, it's kind of the top of the ticket race again, but at the state level.
Now, in Congress in Wisconsin, Republicans won the Republican seats, Democrats won the Democratic seats. The only open one, Republican Glenn Grothman replaced Tom Petri, different temperaments and ideologies there. But are we going to see a competitive congressional race in Wisconsin again in the next, I don't know, 10 years?
Not the way the districts are drawn that I can tell. Now, the seats are pretty safe from what I can tell. And unless there's a lot more moving about within the state of Wisconsin, I don't foresee a lot of movement with regard to any of the seats being particularly competitive.
We're talking with political scientist Lily Gorin about some of the implications from yesterday's midterm elections. You can get in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. It's the day after Election Day, and we are taking a look at the results and what it all means for the political future in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join the conversation with political scientist Lily Gorin at 800-642-1234. I want to hear your questions, your thoughts. How are you feeling about the results? What would you like to see from the next state legislature or Congress in the next couple of years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mary on the line in Prairie du Chien. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Mary?
I'm wondering why I have not heard mention at all that I feel that Michelle Obama backing Mary Burke and campaigning for her hurt Mary Burke quite a bit.
Mary, thanks for the call. Lily, there was talk that, you know, a lot of Senate candidates around the country were avoiding President Obama. Was there was Michelle Obama here in the state maybe a negative somehow for Mary Burke?
Well, I think that, you know, the Mary Burke had more, you know, so-called surrogates coming to Wisconsin to campaign with her. Michelle Obama, Joe Biden, President Obama, Bill Clinton, they all came through the state. And again, that was a difference from the Walker campaign. And there's some interesting analysis with regard to that the number of sort of Washington surrogates coming to Wisconsin had some sort of implications of the recall election when there was a lot of national attention and a lot of folks who came through Wisconsin. And I don't know if I would sort of peg Michelle Obama per se, but I think that the Burke campaign was running a kind of traditional, if you want to, campaign, bringing in people to encourage voters to get out and vote. And it was up against this interesting dynamic that the Walker campaign had, which was really to sort of shy away from bringing outsiders into Wisconsin to advocate for him. And so there was a tonal difference that I think, you know, on some level also impacted the outcome.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm curious to know what your guest thinks. The student vote, the UW student vote, do you think Walker placated them coming out or basically pacified them by freezing the tuition and maybe guaranteeing to freeze the tuition again for the coming year to keep them coming out voting against him, kind of similar to what he did with the Act 10, keeping the sheriff's departments across the state, the enforcers, on his side.
Mike, thanks for the call. Lily Gorin, do you think that made a difference for student voters?
I'm not sure, and I haven't seen a breakdown yet exactly of what the sort of 18 to 24-year-old voters in Wisconsin numbers look like, because they, in the past, during the presidential elections, there had been a really high turnout, relatively speaking, of that age bracket, and I haven't seen that per se with regard to this race specifically. But I think that, you know, I think that it may have around the edges, but given the 5-point spread that Walker had, I don't know if it was substantial in terms of his overall victory.
Thanks for that call. Laura from Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay on the line. She says money is the reason Governor Walker beat Mary Burke. Can you briefly touch on the role of money, campaign spending, and outside groups in this race?
Yeah, there is a lot of money. And again, the sort of specifics to Wisconsin versus the nation, I heard the number of close to $4 billion yesterday discussed nationally. But money is a big issue, and there was, you know, sort of the actual campaigns, the Burke campaign spent more than the Walker campaign, but in terms of the outside groups funding a lot of advertisements and stuff, that's a substantial sort of chunk of change that I believe was spent on the folks who were advocating for Walker's reelection.
Now, looking at the national level now, a lot of talk in the run-up to Election Day about Governor Walker's national hopes. Do you expect to see an announcement sometime between now and Election Day 2016, a Scott Walker for President campaign announcement?
Yes. I don't know what the announcement will look like, but I think that Scott Walker is running for president. I talked to some of my students yesterday in class. I've talked to them on a number of occasions. And I said, you know, he needs to win re-election. If he wins re-election, I think he's absolutely running for president. I think he's really interestingly situated to run. Obviously, he's been down to Iowa a couple of times to campaign for candidates there. He's been to some of the major fundraisers in California and a couple of other places. He's definitely sort of laid the groundwork, but it was also dependent up to this point on winning re-election and doing it in a sort of comfortable way. He didn't have to run up the numbers. He had to do it comfortably to sort of show that demographically he could win in the state where he had been controversial. And so I think he is positioning himself to run for the Republican nomination. And I think he and Paul Ryan may have worked out, you know, who's going to run. I'm not totally sure because I don't talk to them on a regular basis. But I think that Walker is definitely positioned to make a run at it.
And he's won election here in the state, but he's done it in many ways on a national stage. Does that help season him for first a Republican primary and then for a general election if he's the Republican contender?
Well, you know, again, Paul Ryan had the opportunity to run as a on the national ticket in 2012. So he has that experience that Walker doesn't technically have. At the same time, Walker has spent a lot of time over the last 4 years doing the Sunday morning Washington talk shows, his sort of situation. He has been campaigning for other candidates in other states. He has, you know, he did have a national, he has had national attention, given the controversies that started at the beginning of his at the beginning of his administration with regard to the unions. He has attracted some big fundraisers and donors to help his reelection, and so I think in a lot of ways, you know, he's a Midwesterner, which is always attractive on the national stage because we're calm, apparently, and you know we aren't coastal, and so I think in a lot of ways Walker is very well positioned to make a run at it.
We'll go now to Jim on the line in Osceola. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question for the guest is, does she think that the governor now will make decisions for Wisconsin based on positioning himself for a run for the president or for the best interests of Wisconsin?
Lily?
Well, not able to go into Scott Walker's head, but I think that the decisions that he would make, he'll say, are for the best for Wisconsin, and that they also may position him for the presidential run. I don't think he's going to, you know, advocate for a policy or sort of define himself in such a way that it's going to be, you know, at odds with a national run. But he still has to make the case. He has to make the case. He's coming out of this governor's office, and he has to demonstrate to Republicans, and then if he gets the nomination, to the nation, what he's done in Wisconsin and what it has done for Wisconsin to make Wisconsin better. So he has to, you know, he has to put those things together. And we see this often with regard to governors who come out of a governor's office to run for president. We saw it with President George W. Bush. We saw it with President Clinton. We saw it with Ronald Reagan. You know, we've had quite a run of governors that have, you know, made the move to the national stage also by, you know, essentially making the decisions in their state that they then say they want to take on the national stage.
Briefly, wanted to get your thoughts, Lily, before we're done. Republican U.S. Senate now. Do you think President Obama and the leaders of two Republican chambers of commerce, Congress, can work together and pass some legislation?
Mitch McConnell said in his speech last night that that was what he was interested in doing. President Obama said that in his press conference today. That was what he was interested in doing. They haven't, over the last 6 years, had a, you know, sort of fine and loving relationship. But it will be interesting, again, to see with a new crop of senators in the Senate and with and expecting to have Mitch McConnell as the majority leader, he's going to have to figure out how he's going to lead the Senate in that regard and lead the Republicans in the Senate. And some of them are not necessarily going to be as on board with working with the president as others. Ted Cruz has been talking about it up until Election Day and subsequently with regard to he's not always interested in working with the president.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. It's time for Wisconsin Life. The idea of dog sledding probably brings to mind Alaska or the Yukon. But Andrea Thalassinos became a musher in Wisconsin. She tells us how she fell in love with Siberian huskies and recreational dog sledding.
Snow crunches under furred feet at first light. Aluminum dog tags tinkle as the whoosh of the plastic runners of the sled slice through the buttercream trail. Against the backdrop of frosted trees, it's early, but then we're always the first to scatter the night's dusty accumulation. Puffs of steamy breath, like old steam engines, choo-choo from my dog's mouths, and snowbeards frost up their whiskered faces like salty old sea captains. Inhales and exhales pound in time with paws as they catapult the sled forward. Shoulder-checking each other with glee, they race in tandem to beat a nose ahead. Twenty-two years ago, for all the wrong reasons, I'd wanted a husky. They were beautiful, had sky blue eyes, my kids were old enough, and that's it, we were getting one. I answered a newspaper ad, a guy who thought he was getting a golden retriever in wolf's clothing. Realizing the mistake early on, he thought to recoup the money for a 5.5-month-old. As I stepped through the guy's apartment, my eyes fixed on Basha's happy-go-lucky blue gaze through a sliding glass door. All my husband asked was, "Would you take a personal check?" Soon, one husky turned into two. Huskies are like potato chips. You can't have just one. Then the mailman clued me in on a neighbor with a dog sled. The instant my dogs were harnessed and hooked to the gang line, genetic memory kicked in. The sled careened with all the primordial force and power of the Chukchi people's love and a millennia of breeding. That was it for me. 4 days a week, for 9 years, our little ragtag team of six, me, a Greek-American, originally from New York, and my dogs, ran up and down the snowy hills of Wisconsin's quiet wonderlands. They say the child is father to the man, but I'd also say that the dog is teacher to the human. This most ancient form of transportation relies on trust, understanding, and the merging of canine and human intention. It's captured in Central Park on an 87-year-old statue of Balto, a Siberian Husky lead dog who helped transport a diphtheria antitoxin to the remote village of Nome, Alaska, in the winter of 1925. During the worst of the blizzard, transportation of this life-saving medicine was impossible, except by dog, wooden sled, and the mushers who trusted their teams. Engraved on Balto's statue reads, "Endurance, fidelity, and intelligence." I learned these from my precious dogs, my team, during those cold, snowy winters. The trail turns sharply to the right. In unison, my dogs leap forward, barreling towards it. I grasp the handlebar tighter, make sure my feet are firmly planted on the rubber treads. My stomach squeezes like I'm on the downhill of a roller coaster. Their excitement is electric. Hair stands on my body, though I'm not cold. It's a new trail. Not knowing what's around the bend eggs them on all the more.
Commentator Andrea Thalassinos is the author of the novel An Echo Through the Snow.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org. Our next guest says the pace of life is accelerating beyond our control. Faster versions of computers, markets, food, fashion, and childhood keep coming while we struggle to fit it all in. And the speed of communication, information, and networking keeps getting faster, too.
The culprit, according to our next guest, is technology and all that comes with it. Mark C. Taylor joins us now. He's a philosopher and critic and professor and chair in the Department of Religion at Columbia University. He's the author of the new book, Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be there. The dog sled was a perfect segue into this.
Yeah, how so?
It was about slowness, deliberation, return to the natural world. Really quite wonderful.
Yeah, not many people dog sledding still in Wisconsin, although you make the case for it there. You write that the speed of technology keeps accelerating and that it's remaking our lives in its own image. What do you mean by that?
I think many of us feel this, that these technologies that for many years people told us would liberate us are really now enslaving us. These technologies that were supposed to save us time are leaving us with little no time. These technologies that were supposed to connect us and bring us closer together are dividing us. In the late 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of consideration about the ways in which technology was going to create a world where everybody was going to be working only 20 hours. Indeed, in 1971 or two, President Nixon appointed a commission to consider what we would do with all the leisure time when that came. That's not the way it's turned out. We're wired 24/7, 365. There's no respite. There's been a change in the social value of leisure. In previous periods, leisure social status was measured by how little you work. It's now measured by how much you work. It's created a culture of anxiety in which people aren't willing to take the vacation that they deserve because they're afraid they'll lose their job or someone else will replace them. And that anxiety trickles down to children, creating a condition in which children are anxious.
Well, how much of this is voluntary? Do we enter into willingly? People are, you know, pretty attached to their smartphones. People don't want to go on vacations a lot of the time if they're not going to have internet access. Maybe want to partake in, say, Skype conversations at work that may be happening thanks to technology. So is this a deal that we have made consciously? And now maybe we're just sort of figuring out what happens next with all the changes that have been made.
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, we make the decision at one level whether or not to buy the iPhone. But it's also built into our economic system. Part of the problem is you can't understand these changes without having a bit of a historical perspective and without understanding the ways in which various factors come together. We're in a new form of capitalism. It's what I call financial capitalism. That has emerged since the 70s as a result of computing and networking technologies. There's a difference about this new form of capitalism. In previous forms of capitalism, wealth is created by selling labor or selling stuff. In this form of capitalism, wealth is created by speculating and trading in signs that are really virtual. There's no real stuff there, as it were. We also have an economic system that, at least since the Second World War, is predicated upon the necessity of growth. If you have an economy that's predicated on necessity of growth, there are only three ways in which markets can expand. Spatially, you open a new branch in a new town or new country. Differentially, you create a new, different product. When Obama was elected the first time, the iPhone hadn't been introduced. There's been a new model of the iPhone every year since he's been in office. We're now on iPhone 6, and people are lining up, camping out overnight to buy iPhone 6. The only way in which the market can function is if people spend money they don't have for stuff they don't need. The final way is acceleration, that you accelerate the product cycle. So the obsession with speed and innovation is, in effect, a way to expand the market by accelerating the product cycle from fashion to iPhones.
Now, you talk about this as taking a big hit on leisure time, and yet Americans, as you say, don't always take all of the vacation time that they're offered. Last year alone, I think there were millions of hours of unused vacation time left on the table. Is it that we don't know what to do with leisure time, or is it that we just don't feel that we can take it because we'll miss out?
I think there are two answers to that question. One, the latter point you make, is that people are concerned about being unconnected because someone else will do their job, take their job. I mean, there's enormous anxiety about job security, as we all know. But the second is a more subtle point, and that's the one I mentioned before. It's the question of social status, that leisure, as I say, in the 20s and 30s, your social, the less you worked, the higher your social status. The more you worked, the lower your social status. Now, if you're not connected all the time, you're inconsequential. It's as if, you know, it's as if importance is measured by being wired and connected 24/7, 365. And we all know the toll that this takes. It takes an enormous toll. I was teaching my class today of undergraduates here at Columbia, and I asked the class, how many of you sleep with your iPhone beside your bed? Every single student in the class raised his or her hands.
And what do you see as being wrong with that, or troubling?
Part of the problem, it seems to me, is I think the system that we created is unsustainable. I think it's unsustainable socially. I think it's unsustainable psychologically, and I think it's unsustainable economically. And I think this kind of constant frenzy cultivates a set of virtues that are counterproductive, and that it represses, as it were, virtues that are needed. The problems we face are enormous. The election that we had yesterday would be comic were it not so tragic. There's absolutely no addressing the most critical problems that society faces, the unsustainability of the wealth gap. The wealth gap that we face is, in effect, a speed gap. That is to say, we have created two economies that run on two different speeds, the real economy, which is slow, and the virtual economy, which is fast. And that wealth gap will continue to accelerate because virtual assets, these, you know, these financial instruments and like, scale at a rate that greatly exceeds the real economy. Environmentally, we are creating a system of growth that cannot be sustained. The growth that we gain still depends upon fossil fuels, precious metals, all of which are exhaustible. We now have fracking, which in effect is going to put on delay any serious development of alternative energies and sustainable practices for a considerable time because of these resources. So to solve the problems we face, you need they have to be long-range planning. It has to be deliberation. There has to be patience. Difficult problems don't lend themselves to quick and easy solutions.
We're talking right now with Mark C. Taylor. He's a philosopher and critic and professor of and chair in the Department of Religion at Columbia University. He's the author of the new book, Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the speed of life today. Accelerating, our guest says, beyond our control, thanks to our technology and our attachment to it. How do you see technology and speed driving culture affecting your life? Do you think it helps or hurts our social connections, our environment, our economy, and ourselves? Are the benefits worth the price?
We're talking about speed right now, fast computers, speed dating, speed trading, the accelerated 24/7 media cycle. We're living it right now, and our guest says it's not good for us and it's not sustainable. Mark C. Taylor is with us. He's a philosopher and critic, the author of the book Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is the world just too fast moving? Are we sacrificing leisure to stay connected, to stay productive? Are we too reliant on technology? Do we have to know everything now? Does it really benefit us? Or is it all worth it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take a caller now. Dennis joins us from Appleton. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I don't think people realize that they need time to disconnect and wind down, that when they're connected 24/7, that does take a toll on them, the stress, everything else, and I don't think they realize how critical it is to have some downtime.
OK, Okay, thank you, Dennis. And Mark, what do you think about that? Do we need downtime to process and to wind down?
I think we need it not only to wind down, but I think we need it to think and reflect. There are only two things people don't think they have enough of ever, and that's time and money. And very often that's the trade-off. We give up time in order to earn more money. But again, when was the last time you were unplugged? When was the last time you weren't bombarded with noise? When was the last time you took long enough to read a long and challenging book, not on a screen, but an actual book, and to think and reflect about it? The world has not only become much faster, it's become much, much more complex. And that kind of complexity takes time and reflection to think about. Short-term answers to long-term problems are not adequate. So it's part of it is rest and recuperation, but part of it is reflection and thinking. Students don't read the same way as they used to. They read a lot and they write a lot, but it's short, it's quick, it's fast. They don't read, their eyes don't read the same way on a screen as on a page, as on a printed page. They can't write long, they can't sustain an argument over a long period. I taught a seminar last year, which had to write, undergraduates had to write a 20 to 25 page seminar paper, term paper. No student in that, and this is at an Ivy League university, had ever written a paper of 20 to 25 pages.
Hmm. So some changes happening there at lots of different levels. Dennis, thank you so much for that call. And we'll turn next to Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to add?
Oh, okay. Just want to say that this technology, this rapid information, is still really new to all of us. So it's kind of like a kid getting his hand on candy. They want more, they want more, they want more. Eventually, as we grow up, we're going to learn how to kind of pace ourselves and do what's right. So I think that's just my point of view. I'll take my comment out there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Adam. And Adam's saying, you know, maybe we're at the beginning of a learning curve here, that right now we haven't learned self-control, we haven't learned how to modulate our use of it, but that will come in time. Do you buy that?
Only partially. Part of the difficulty, and this goes back to the question that you asked me about whether it's choice or not, part of the problem is these problems are systemic. That is, we've created a system, a structural system, that's built upon this kind of accelerated pace of change. And one of the characteristics of this system is we all have heard about the tipping point, that in these systems, it's not only that things accelerate, but the rate of acceleration accelerates, and you can't simply slow it down solely by your own individual system. We've created an overall economic system that can't be sustained environmentally. I mean, this economic development that we have in this rapid rate of change is destroying the environment, and we don't know when we've passed what they call the tipping point in some of these changes. By the time we realize what we're doing, it may be too late to fix it. That's why we need to slow down and reflect on this. And you can't understand this without understanding the interrelationship between technology, between values, between economics. All of that is interconnected. It's complicated, and it takes time to unravel.
Now, one thing that people have suggested in various forms over the last couple of years has been, you know, that maybe we need to make space to unplug, to go completely offline, to just distance ourselves. Sometimes it's been called a sabbatical from technology. Sometimes it's just, you know, referred to as a break every week. You can take a time and take a day, take a week, unplug, take a summer. Is that reasonable? And is that part of the solution here? Or is there a middle ground?
I think that would help enormously on the individual level, and I think that kind of experience would, as one of the previous callers suggested, be rewarding and refreshing. But again, that alone isn't enough. We have to understand in order to slow this down, it's not just a matter of stopping and smelling the roses, though that's not unimportant. we have to make systemic changes, and that will require various legislation and various regulations that in today's political climate are going to be very difficult, if not impossible.
So how can you legislate slowing down?
Let's take financial markets. Financial markets are now operating in nanoseconds. High-speed, high-volume markets trade. 70% of the trades now being done are on high-speed, high-volume markets. During your segment today, you just said that the stock market was higher, had reached a new all-time high. That market has virtually nothing to do with the real economy. It's a game. It's a massive multi-user online game that's being run by algorithms at a rate so fast that traders in Chicago cannot trade on New York financial markets because of the time of the few seconds required to transmit buy sell orders. You can do things to slow that down. You can do two things. One, you can increase what's called collateral by requiring banks to have more collateral on hand to offset their investments that they're making. And two, you could put in transaction fees for every transaction that is made. Now, it's possible that transaction fee, because we're talking about millions and millions and millions of trades being made every day. It's possible that the amount of wealth being generated there, the trades wouldn't go, but that would generate revenue that could be used elsewhere. There have to be environmental regulations that are not only national but international. That will require global cooperation. It's not only a problem of getting Republicans and Democrats together. The problems that we face do not know boundaries. They require international cooperation, and there's going to have to be some kind of legislation and regulation to slow this down. Carbon tax.
And Mark, in our final moments here, how can we do this when it feels as though if we do pull back and slow down, we're going to lose out or maybe drop out altogether, not be competitive?
I would say we're going to lose out if we don't slow down. The only way to get ahead is to slow down at this point. The Earth is not flat, like Tom Friedman says, metaphorically, of course. The flat Earth suggests infinite expansion. The Earth is round, both literally and figuratively, and that means that there are constraints, there are limits. There can be no expansion without contraction somewhere else. Redistribution of wealth and redistribution of resources is dismissed as a socialist nightmare. It's not a policy. It's not an option. It's a necessity. China cannot continue to expand without us going back. So slowing down, pulling back, is the only survival strategy that makes sense.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark C. Taylor, philosopher and critic and professor and chair in the Department of Religion at Columbia University. He's the author of the new book, Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left.